building type, but also are considering the availability and affordability of rental housing.
So I appreciate that perspective, and I agree with it, I guess. But I also think about the fact that it's happening. And so mm-hmm. we either choose to provide an avenue for it to happen legally, or we, you know, we sort of operate in this realm where we think it's not happening and it is. So I guess that's where I'm torn on this issue.
So I think there's a spectrum between, you know, actively enforcing against it, knowing that some amount of it is going on, and then facilitating it. And yeah, my personal opinion is our posture should be somewhere between the first two, not moving on to facilitating. You know, as opposed to, say, you know, the PSC recommendation around single-family building types, where, you know, the recommendation actually will encourage ADU development, which in the long term may expand Portland's housing supply. So,
picking up on Dan's point, let me throw two wrinkles into our conversation. First is, to me, there's a distinction between crossing, having someone cross the threshold of my house and someone gaining access to a multifamily residential building. I mean, you have to be buzzed in or allowed in to most multifamily buildings. So someone has to take responsibility and say, you're allowed in. But once you're in for all purposes.
Wow,
that's number one. The second point is what makes us a little different in terms of this question about the underground conduct is occurring, mm-hmm. whether we regulate it or not, is that with single family, we don't allow it, but the owner-occupant is not violating necessarily any covenant they have with anyone else. Mm-hmm. Maybe they have a problem with their insurance company that'll come up. Maybe they have a problem with their mortgage company if it ever comes up. But they're not. And I can't imagine they're clearly violating some covenant. I took a look at master apartment leases generally because I was curious about this point. In every one that we've surveyed, there are two clauses which make this per se illegal from the point of view of the landlord and the tenant. Mm-hmm. And it either kicks in under the no subletting, and we're all familiar with this because we've all been renters. It's either under the no subletting clause, which says without our permission, and most landlords are not going to give that permission under these circumstances. And number two is there's the conduct or representation clause, which says the dwelling units to be used exclusively as a dwelling, no commercial activity is to be allowed. And the question is, does this constitute commercial activity? Do we cross that line? So this is a little different in that if there's an offense in a single family context, it's against the owner occupant. If in a multifamily situation, almost invariably what we would be sanctioning would be currently disallowed under the terms of the lease agreement. And I think at a very least that creates a whole web of complexity that for me suggests we should decouple these issues and do a deeper dive, including engaging the industry on multifamily. Because ultimately we might be sanctioning something that by agreement they prohibit. And I believe almost every written agreement has one or both of these clauses.
And I can share two personal experiences that illustrate that. One is that I own an income property. It's a condominium in the Pearl. And my homeowners association will not allow me to rent it for less than 30 days. So if I used it for Airbnb, I'd be violating my condo association covenants. And then I had an interesting Airbnb experience in Seattle. I had not used Airbnb when we discussed this at the commission. I had a trip coming up, so I took the opportunity to use myself as a test case and rented a unit for several days following a convention trip. And got to the building. It was an apartment building. And my partner and I came through the door with our suitcases, and the apartment manager said, "What are you doing here?" And after a few evasive answers, confessed that it was Airbnb and was told that I was not welcome to stay. Now, the Airbnb system, to its credit, probably did the right thing, immediately canceled my reservation and refunded my money. But clearly there was activity going on that the management company for the apartment, indeed, they said that the federal covenants for their funding did not allow subletting, and they were adamant that, you know, my partner and I were not going to stay there that night. So. There are conflicts that will be created if we look at multifamily, for sure.
So I guess the mayor said, you know, we're entering sort of a new area, this shared mm-hmm. economy, and so it's not unreasonable to expect perhaps that the lease provisions Commissioner Fish just cited could evolve over time to mm-hmm. accommodate the shared economy too.
Well, it will evolve, but be careful what you ask for. If you're the landlord of that building, it will evolve, and you'll simply reclaim all the units and become an Airbnb operator once you find out that you can make a lot more money than leasing to Charlie Hales. I mean, one of the reasons that under subsidized housing, Dan, this is per se illegal is because the unit is only for the person who qualifies for that unit. So you can't get a subsidized unit and then run it as a business. Here, you have a different set of criteria, which is the landlord has screened you for that unit, and they're renting to you for a single rate, and you are now turning it into a commercial enterprise. And I can't imagine a situation where the landlord is going to consent to that. Now, maybe over time they may, but until the industry gets to a point where they're going to reconsider that, I would have a problem with us regulating something that we know is in violation of the terms of every lease agreement with every tenant in the city.
Well, Chair Baugh's perspective was that the landlord might cooperate by knowing that they could raise your rent because you have this extra income stream.
I think there's a couple of other issues, though. First, as Sandra mentioned, it wasn't flushed out at the Planning Sustainability Commission. It was taken off the table pretty early. So although we heard from a lot of folks in multifamily who would like to be able to do it at the council hearing, we didn't hear from a lot of those opposed to it. So I think there's a process issue. I don't think we should move forward stuffing it in at the last minute here. If the council wants to, we can look at it again in the future. The second point, though, is that it's really different renting a room in a house with a primary occupant versus renting a room that's immediately adjacent to somebody else's room through possibly a very paper-thin wall, and that the behaviors, the conflict, the potential for noise and other annoyances in a multifamily situation are much greater. I was also persuaded by the testimony from the Planning Sustainability Commission at our hearing about the issue of egress, and I would want to have it posted on the door as to how to get out of that building, and especially in the event of not being able to use the elevator.
So Sandra got it right when she linked these two, but they are different. And from this discussion, I agree with those comments, Commissioner Fritz. Let me make sure I've got this straight in my head, and that is where we stand with the PSC recommendation is that we're not writing any code on this subject, right? We're writing code on the subject of what you can do and how you can do it in single-family residences, which we get to again in number 10 because they're just a different kind of single-family residence.
Right.
And we are silent on what happens in multifamily structures. We're not prohibiting anything. We're just not allowing it as a permitted use for which you can obtain this permit, right?
Let's be clear. It's prohibited if we don't regulate, if we don't authorize
right,
it.
Right, but we're not enforcing that now in multi. It's getting enforced. I don't think
enforced
we are.
Enforced by complaint.
It's getting enforced by landlords.
And by complaints. If we receive a complaint, then we would enforce it just like we would single dwelling.
The fact that it's we're silent in the code, but it's not allowed means that there still is a potential for a complaint-based code violation. Okay.
That's correct.
Partly because even under what we've heard previously, if this was to be allowed, it would have to be the units would have to be significantly upgraded to provide to meet a higher standard of life safety, right?
That's correct. Provided they're not already to that level.
So I just want to be clear on that last point. So you could, under what we're talking about, you could build a multifamily condo or apartment building, and if you build it to hotel occupancy standards, you could allow the residents or tenants to participate in Airbnb type programs or not?
Right. So the recommendation from the Planning Commission is that even if you built to the hotel occupancy, you would not be able to use a short-term rental program for those units. The affordability issues, the noise complaints issues,
to Commissioner Saltzman's point, if a future developer came to us and said, I'm willing to make this extraordinary investment to bring it up to this standard, and I have buyers that want it, I would like an exception for this particular class of uses, that's an entirely different situation coming to us than what we have now. Because now we know, among many other things, that the buildings aren't up to those standards.
Well, yes, and also, though, it then becomes more of a commercial enterprise. And you can go through the process to get the B&B or something, right?
let's be clear, too, that the Planning Sustainability Commission didn't say one way or another how they thought multifamily should be regulated. They were presented early on with the idea that it was not going to be allowed through the building code, and that you would have had to make these major upgrades. So they turned away at that point and didn't continue the discussion. So I'm kind of where Commissioner Fritz is on this, and saying that that discussion didn't happen. That said, we know that between now and, you know, the next forever, anyway, in the next 20 years, 80% of the new construction in Portland is going to be multifamily. It's not going to be single family. So we do need to deal with this. I just don't think that the commission, the Planning Sustainability Commission, has done that in a thorough way to bring that to you.
I might add that the new construction meet those requirements of sprinkler and egress and escape issues that are, and that these concerns are applied to older apartment buildings that don't currently meet those codes. So then it comes down to a policy issue, not a code issue per se.
And I want to add for one point of clarification too, because I think we're making the connection that if it's a multi-dwelling unit, then it wouldn't be a primary residence. But the I think that requirement would stay. If you wanted to expand this to multi-dwelling, it still needs to be for somebody's primary residence. Would the chances increase that that person is gone more than they are in a single dwelling? I don't know.
You heard the very compelling testimony from the young woman who is pursuing her education and offsets those costs by renting out one of her rooms. So that probably, from our point of view, is the ideal situation, because you've got an occupant, it's primary residence, you have an occupant, and it's going to a good cause. The question is, in her case, it's highly likely that it's a violation of her of a covenant in her lease agreement. And if it's not a modern building, and presumably if she's on a budget, she's not in one of the recent buildings market rate that have gone up, then she's probably not a unit that meets our standards. So there's complications.
And another, I'd feel a little remiss in not mentioning that a lot of single dwelling units are also renter occupied. 25% of Portland's single dwelling units are renter occupied. So that's where the owner-occupied versus renter-occupied conversation starts to come in, and do we care to differentiate between those two, which we have said no, we don't. We want to offer this opportunity to a renter, if their landlord agrees to that, great. Then they can have extra income too.
Okay, want to move on to number 10? So this is detached, I'm sorry, attached single-family.
Not necessarily.
Not just
it
that,
could right? be detached single family. So I think we can all picture apartments and condos. We can all picture townhouses or row houses or whatever you call them. And usually townhouses or row houses are on their own sites. So there's a land division, and the person who owns a townhouse also owns the land underneath them. So they're covered under the single dwelling provisions that before you. But sometimes you have townhouses that look like townhouses, but they are all on one site. Sometimes they're all rented out, so there's one property owner and they're all rented out. Sometimes they're all, it's one structure, but they're condominiumized. So each of the townhouses has their own owner, and they have a condo association that owns the land. You also sometimes have single houses, just detached houses, that are also all on one site, and those can also be condominium or all owned in common and rented out. In the latter two cases, we consider those in the zoning code as multi-dwelling development, and you're correct, Commissioner Fish, in pointing out before that those are reviewed under the one and two family dwelling code provisions of the building code, but in the zoning code, they're considered multi-dwelling development. When we were looking into this, we the rationale behind the code is that we're regulating by structure type, not by zone in this case. And to allow it for multi-dwelling development, even though they're regulated under the one and two dwelling building code, we felt just added another layer of complexity to the regulations and made them just really complex. There's no other provision in the zoning code that points to how the building code regulates something for what we want to allow for land use, in other words.
Okay. Good clarification. Questions, concerns about this one? All right. Monitoring, number 11.
So number 11, monitoring, Commissioner Fritz recommended an amendment to the ordinance and asking BPS to return to council with a monitoring report by September 2016. So we're okay with that. We can definitely do that.
Sounds like a fine idea. Any concerns? Okay. Discussion? Is that the right date? I think it is. Because it will have been in effect for
a couple of years.
A year and change, maybe 2 years.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. The question number 12 was the impact on other cities' affordable housing stock. We have done internet searches. The most information, and I sent you that report before you. I believe that was in the testimony at the Planning Commission also. It's a report done by a consultant who looked at the San Francisco market. Their conclusion, in short, was that the strong job market in San Francisco was bringing many, many people to San Francisco. I think I can't remember what the numbers were. And that was really what was increasing the demand for housing in San Francisco and thus increasing the rents in the city. And that the number of short-term rentals that were occurring were such a small proportion of the overall housing stock that they didn't see a causation effect from that. That's a summary of that report.
It is noteworthy that that there's a ballot measure percolating in San Francisco to overturn what the council did, brought by affordable housing advocates who believe, based on their assessment, that there is a negative impact on the availability of affordable housing units. So it may be that it's a new enough experiment that there just isn't enough conclusive data one way or another. Or it's harder to pull out a single causation threat. There could be multiple reasons why San Francisco is becoming unaffordable. San Francisco actually may not be the best example of a city, because it really is a city of such divergent extremes. I mean, Dan mentions this a lot. I'm not sure. Is there a middle class living in San Francisco anymore, given the cost of living? I mean, so it may not be the perfect test case.
And I think because we're coming back in 2 years with monitoring report, we'll be able to tell you at least what we know. I think it'll be hard to be conclusive on any of this unless you were to do an extensive study. But we'll come back in 2 years and be able to tell you what we know so far in terms of those impacts.
Okay. Number 13, license numbers.
So the question was, will a license number be assigned to operators? And yes, they will be assigned a permit number through BDS, and that's available, again, on portlandmaps.com, which many members of the public use. Number 14, federal regulations. Do federal regulations exist to regulate this kind of housing? Just to clarify again, renting a bedroom in a unit is not a type of housing. It's kind of accessory, an extra use, and we aren't familiar with any federal regulations related to renting a bedroom on a nightly basis, and all applicable federal, state, and local laws would still apply, including income tax, transient lodging tax, et cetera. Building codes, of course.
Thank you. Cleared that up. Now, taxes, more complicated subject. Terry, you want to take that on?
Sure. Take it on? Okay. Regardless of the action on the short-term rentals, everyone who's doing this action under the Transient Lodging Code should be collecting taxes for any rentals that are 30 days or less. I can tell you that based on numbers that I've seen, we only have a very, very small fraction of folks who are doing that. So one of the things with this, these kind of codes going on, and if you approve this, then one, it gives us the ability to make sure that we're getting those taxes from the folks, because those that apply for the permits, we can get that information. We can make sure that they're registered either directly with us or that the platform that they're using has registered with us and collecting those taxes and everything like that. So, but as of today, everybody doing this should be taking taxes from the guests that they have and remitting them to the city of Portland. And they're not. So that's one of the things that's going on.
Just to be clear, the person that knows in their heart they should be paying is also thinking, if I remit this payment, they're going to get a letter from you saying, oh, thank you very much, and by the way, please don't think of this as ingratitude, but what you're doing is illegal. And
we don't do that. We don't do that. We say thank you for registering, and here's your reports, and this is the rules, and everything like that.
Say happily, the city exists in silos. We never talk to each other.
They are complaint driven. We don't get complaints. So, yeah.
You know, there's a lot of words on this page about the challenges of verifying compliance in a relationship like the Airbnb model. Can you just, in plain English, tell us, do you have any concerns that you'll be able to verify compliance with tax requirements?
I believe that if council passes this, and one of the pieces, either through an administrative rule or through guidance, does request or require that the permit number be posted in advertising and everything like that, I think that does help us with compliance. We can do a lot of work in compliance during audits. And we will be doing that, because we will look, particularly in the case of Airbnb, where there are multiple locations, we will do samples on that and make sure that at certain periods of time throughout the audit period that various locations have been remitted properly, calculated properly, turned things. So we can get a lot of compliance information through an audit, and that's allowed.
I just want to make sure we understand the legal landscape here. Are there two taxable events here?
I don't think there's two taxable events. But what are you thinking?
Well, Charlie's renting out his guest room, mm-hmm. so he has to pay transient lodging taxes on that transaction.
The guest has to remit. The guest pays them, and Charlie would remit them.
Remits them to Airbnb.
Yes.
And
no.
Airbnb is
no.
Sorry.
Okay. In the case of Airbnb, they are going to take on that responsibility of collecting everything and remitting them on behalf of their hosts.
Okay.
That's so
something we're requiring.
No, that's not something we're requiring at all. Basically, the person who operates the home, whether they have their own web page or they go through five different potential intermediaries, it's their ultimate responsibility to collect that tax from the guests and remit it to the city.
So that's the transient lodging taxes.
Yes.
And the only question is whether Charlie pays it or the company that he contracts, in this case Airbnb, pays it. But Charlie has to pay a fee to Airbnb to participate of 1%, and then my wife and I that want to be in his guest room have to pay a percentage mm-hmm. to. So that creates a revenue stream. Is that subject to our business license fee?
Yes, both. Provided that you've actually got two folks that would be under potentially the business license tax, and that would be, again, the person who's operating that, because they're operating a business. And in the case of Airbnb, if there is nexus here with the city, then that, too, would be subject to the business tax as well.
Well, I read somewhere they're moving their headquarters to Old Town. So
that will create nexus.
Will that help
yes.
us with nexus?
That will help with nexus. Yes, it will.
And are we back to that old problem of if it's an internet provider that's not domiciled in Oregon, we would lose the nexus? Or they would argue they don't have a nexus?
There could certainly be an argument about nexus, because generally nexus, you need to have some kind of a physical presence usually doing that. And that's kind of where the internet, you don't, unless you have a place where your servers are located, and those servers create a physical nexus or things like that.
So I get that the fee that my brother pays to Airbnb to stay in Charlie's apartment, which is paid in New York, we have no nexus. Mm-hmm. But the fee that Charlie's paying to Airbnb for the privilege of being the Airbnb network, don't we have clearly a nexus over that?
That's an excellent question, and we'll have to look at that. I'm not 100% sure. If Charlie, I mean, certainly if the fees on the locations that are here and everything, then we would certainly potentially say yes, at least on those locations we do. Yes, okay. I hadn't thought of that one.
So, I think that has gotten us through the questions that were raised either by us or by citizens at the hearing. Thank you. Are there other questions or follow-up discussions like this one that we ought to throw into the mix? For
I'd be interested in the tax questions, because that will come under certainly a lot of scrutiny. And where is the, what's the path of least resistance for you folks? It does seem to me all the fees that are paid by the operator or by the operator to the third party here in Oregon ought to be fair game for us to monitor. I guess the second thing is to Susan and Paul, if we end up punting or deferring on the multifamily question, what would be your normal process for taking that up? How would you? What would be your timeline, and when might it come back to us for recommendations?
So Paul and I and our staff have met recently, actually, on what's going to be a recap 7, so you can do this all again on other topics. And one of the things we're coming up with is that there is a short list of things that we want to get done every year. And then there's some issues that are a little bit bigger, like this one, than the traditional recap. And we'll probably pick a couple of those. And they may take 18 months instead of 12 months. And so we're putting together a schedule right now. That schedule is then advertised, and it goes to the Planning and Sustainability Commission for approval in terms of our work plan each year. And so that comes to the Planning Sustainability Commission in August. And so what I need here is direction a little bit, at least in general, about did you want us to do multifamily right away? Do you want us to wait until we do the two-year report and then come back? Do you want to think about it? It can always be, we always do other code issues too that aren't necessarily a part of recap anyway. So a little bit of direction around that. Probably I should be talking to the mayor a little bit about you know, his direction.
So you're saying recap 7 is going to start in August?
We'll get approval, and you know, so the fiscal year is in. We're putting together our list now. We'll take that to the Planning and Sustainability Commission in August for approval for the work plan. Yes.
So that's the work plan, not the code. So we get approval from the commission and hold a hearing, and then we start our public outreach and code writing, and then we'll be before you next spring again.
Well, I guess I go back to my thesis. This is happening in multifamily, regardless of whether we want to look at it as happening or not. So I would urge that it be part of the recap 7 and not wait the 2 years. I think that's
too long,
and that's unfair to people who are affected by this one way or the other of what's going on unsanctioned.
I disagree. I think we should see how it works out in the short term, in the single family first, and there are a lot of other much more pressing issues that we need to fix in the zoning code. And I was happy that this was dealt with as part of recap. But when we're looking at comprehensive plan implementation and some of the other big questions that people are worried about, like design in neighborhoods and demolitions and other hot-button topics, it seems to me that this one has had a pretty fair turn, and it would be better to wait and see how it works out before we put it in recap 7.
Other feelings on this question?
I'm not a member of the council, but this is a technical point.
We have an announcement today?
No, I'm not running. We have been in very close conversation with the state about, and the mayor mentioned the letter from state being somewhat general, it is. And I think there was concern from the state of making a statewide interpretation on this issue, given that it's more of a Portland sort of situation right now. But we have discussed following up with them to get a more specific interpretation. And so wherever this goes, one of the suggestions from the state is maybe looking at a local ordinance provision that would address this issue more specifically to the city of Portland rather than the state itself. And so we do plan on continuing that conversation, but wanted to, like Susan was asking, get more direction from this session as to how do we continue on with this specific area of the short-term rental conversation.
There's some other resource people here. I mean, I'd like to hear from the commission about whether they think this is a topic we ought to take up. There's some folks here from the multifamily industry. So now or later, you know, we don't have to decide this today, but the staff does need direction about this. I think it would be helpful to get some feedback, because I think the point you raised, Dan, is very sound, that regardless of what we do or don't do, you know, this practice is going to continue at some level in the multifamily buildings. Some renters, some guests are going to have the experience that Chris unfortunately had, where they find out that there's a failure to understand the rules between the occupant of that the renter of that multifamily building unit and their participation in a network like Airbnb. So, you know, this is going to rumble on at some level, regardless of when we take it up. I think the question is, where does this stand in the relationship to other issues that we do have to use our bandwidth on?
So if we're encouraging the Planning Commission and the multifamily housing industry to weigh in with us following this hearing, I'd also like to know from the multifamily housing industry whether they anticipate changing their philosophy of the rental relationship here, or whether it's happening in other cities in response to this. And is that a natural evolutionary process, or are we going to, no matter what we do, come back to this roadblock that we can regulate this all we want, but most of the tenancies are going to be illegal?
Chris, anything more on the subject? Okay, so we would like to hear from both the rental, the multifamily industry, and the Planning Sustainability Commission about that. But again, for the purposes of the next our next hearing on this package, we are leaving it as it stands in terms of what the PSC's recommendation is on multifamily.
And just to speaking as a staff person who would probably have to work on this, for Recap 7, we basically need our code ready in October. So when we get our marching orders from the Planning Commission, we know what the concept is and we're moving forward. The issues that have been raised today, I don't know if we're going to have more information. We won't have more information. Nothing will have changed between the lease agreements and the condo association rules. We won't have more information about affordable housing. So there isn't anywhere to take information and learn from at this point in order to develop a concept and get the code ready for October to begin our public outreach.
What's so significant about October?
That's just how our timeline works, so we can get to the council by this time next year.
Is that what happened with this Recap 6?
Yes.
You actually begin it in August?
We publish a public draft in January to give the public the 7-8 weeks of review in our open houses and discussing with neighborhood coalition offices before the Planning Commission.
Susan, we've heard from some B&B operators. We've heard from some folks who would like to see some regulatory flexibility for vacation rentals. The one group we haven't heard a lot from are the hotel operators. And yet it just reminds me, going back to San Francisco, the hotel folks are part of the legal challenge that this whole short-term rental regime. Pardon me?
We haven't heard
from either the operators or the unions here expressing any concerns yet. Is that correct?
So obviously you all have the opportunity in terms of Commissioner Saltzman's desire to be able to deal with multifamily. We could just vote on it anyway. You know, you do sometimes in terms of we know what we know, and you could put the question to you on we're going to come back July 2nd, have a second hearing, because some people didn't get the chance to talk the first time, and there may be additional people. And then, you know, you could vote on July 9th. So we could include something that said you would allow short-term rentals in multifamily. You could have that as an amendment, and you would do it based on what you know today, and you could vote it up or down. So, you know. Yeah. So.
Yeah. No, I'm certainly interested in sort of hearing more testimony. There's a lot of good testimony at the first hearing, so I don't know if you need to draft it as an alternative amendment, but I'm still open on this topic, and perplexed, I should say, and ambivalent on. You can see it from different angles.
Yeah, I appreciate your candid attitude on this. I mean, since we're sort of don't know anything about it, we could theoretically go forward based on. Now, I want to make sure. I want to make sure the public does know we are generally, we do go through a fair amount of due diligence when we regulate, but nothing prevents us from regulating without any information. So I just, you know.
Probably not going to be a general practice.
And just one clarification. I think there is some testimony in the previous testimony. It was written testimony from the hotel industry and saying that they just wanted to make sure that there was a level playing field, that the inspections were the same, that the transient taxes were the same, et cetera.
And then finally, there was a lot of, not during the testimony, but there was a lot of action and interaction with our office around the vacation rental owners, sort of associations and groups, wanting us to deal with that too. And so what it really comes down to is something that Commissioner Fritz and the mayor both said, was that, you know, we have a long list of things that you want us to deal with to change in code. And do you want to put these things in front of some of the things dealing with mixed use neighborhood issues, around other issues dealing with neighborhoods that we're trying to get done. So I think that's what the discussion is going to be at the Planning and Sustainability Commission meeting in August, is on this long list of things that we want to get done, what comes up in terms of priority.
So to recap where we are, that is, you're going to bring back amendment proposals, and we're going to have a hearing on the 2nd. We're also going to have amendment proposals in front of the council and the chance to adopt those on the 2nd prior to final adoption on the 9th, or are we going to adopt amendments on the 9th?
We're not meeting on the 9th.
Oh, sorry. 16th, okay. And did I get that right in terms of process?
Correct. So my thinking is, what I heard today is that we'd bring back the initial inspection by BDS, but then, and re-inspection by BDS every 6 years, possibly, and then self-certification in between. That was the amendments that's already on the table. We'd have code language for that. The carbon monoxide detector amendment that Commissioner Saltzman, we've already drafted that. We already have the PSC's recommendation for primary residence being understood to be 6 months, but we should bring an amendment forward that stipulates at least 6 months as one possibility and 9 months as another possibility.
Although I have to say, after this excellent discussion today, I'm not sure of the linkage anymore, since we have a definition of primary residence that doesn't turn on 6 months or 9 months. I think that requires, Mayor, maybe a little more baking, just to think through what's the problem we're trying to solve.
Yeah, and that's not in the zoning code as a definition of primary residence. In our discussions, we consider that permanent residence. Where is your permanent residency as the IRS defines it? So I think we can work with Terry and figure that out. But I think where we drew the conclusion is, do you want to set an intent of how much you anticipate that, or you want that resident to be occupying the unit throughout the year? And is a person being there for 6 months out of the year and being gone for 6 months of the year okay?
In part, because we're looking at short-term rental as an accessory use.
Exactly.
And zoning for your primary use and accessory use.
Exactly. Obviously, it might behoove us to clarify what the intent is and codify that. And then the last one, I think, was the allowing a designee to be the operator. And then I'm hearing that we don't draft up the multi-dwelling structure amendments at this point.
And then having the license on the advertisement, is that something that would be in, that wouldn't have been in the zoning code, it would be in an administrative role or something?
That'd probably be in the revenue, or I don't know where we.
Well, we're asking, I don't know where we regulate how people advertise. And another problem with that license number that occurs to me is, you see a license number, but you don't know if that's an old license number. Have they gotten the renewal or not? It definitely doesn't belong in the zoning code. And if we want to, I don't know how we regulate advertising.
Yeah, and perhaps we can work with Airbnb, who have been good partners in this process, to see if they'd be willing to, for instance, put a link to Portland Maps on their website or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So can I just raise one other process question? This is a somewhat unusual work session in that we have almost a full house, and I'm guessing it's not just all staff. So there's interested parties, Tammy and others who are here who have been following this closely. We're on a pretty fast track right now. What's the protocol for any... What's the preferred protocol for any further comments that we might receive from interested parties? Because if we don't have a protocol, then it'll come to one of us or the other by happenstance. Yeah. We may or may not forward it. What's your preferred way to consolidate any mm-hmm. further comments from this hearing so that the council has the benefit of that thinking going into the July 2nd hearing?
Right. So we do have the hearing on July 2nd, which means that the public testimony is still open. They should email or send a letter or to Carla Mordlove, our council clerk, and it'll get to all the commissioner's office, and it'll get to our office just like a regular hearing.
That's why we continued the hearing, so that we gave people a chance to both continue the discussion we started and have this discussion today by council.
Without putting more work on your shoulders, if a novel issue comes forward that you track, I mean, we do get the emails from Carla saying the public testimony, with the exception of Commissioner Fritz, I'm not sure all of us read it the same day. So could we have an understanding that you will flag to us any new issue that comes up that we hear from the from any interested party, a legal issue, a policy issue that we haven't already ventilated?
Yeah, absolutely, we can do that. We'll be following it closely, and Carla's been forwarding the testimony we received to make sure we're reading it and we're aware of it.
Okay. Good point. Well, again, I want to thank the council for what's been a good discussion today, and the staff of both bureaus for good work on queuing this up for us. It's really no accident that Portland's trying to figure this out first and thoughtfully, because that's our typical position in these issues around the country. So I really appreciate the fact that we've taken this on, and the Planning and Sustainability Commission spent a great deal of time on it, and that we've been able to step our way through this really complicated set of issues in a very different role for the zoning code than anyone would have imagined 10 or 15 years ago. So
there's probably a dozen planning commission directors around the city that have called me and said, let me know exactly what you're doing and when this is going to be done, because we trade these pretty quickly. They'll say, well, we're going to try that as a starting point too.
Great. Well, thank you, everyone, and we will see this issue back on the 2nd. Thank you.